Right, do you want to start by talking about the group shows and the open studios that you were involved in between 84 and 94?
Yeah, when I left Dyers Hill Road, as I said, round about 1990. I don't know, that's round about then. And I moved to what would be considered another small little artistic community, which was John Scare House and Limehouse. And it was like a housing co-op. And I think Acme had some houses there. But somehow through friends, I'd got in, not literally through the back door, but I went to something like Quadrant Housing, which is in Bethnal Green Road, and they managed to get me a short let place, a similar place, but in flats in Limehouse, right on the water there. But my friends, who were living there, they had Acme spaces. So Acme obviously still had some houses there. And I think they were paying, I think we all ended up paying like £11 a week. It was amazing. But I didn't have a studio there. I then sublet a studio, again, inadvertently, through Acme. It was some prefabs that were down Stepney Way. There were three or four prefabs. And I sublet one of an artist called Phil Howard. And it was just a prefab building with a garden, sort of 1930s that Acme had had. So I sublet a space of him and started to make work there that was sort of based around small little bronze works that were made in wax on my finger and then cast into bronze. And then I was invited by Adam Reynolds and Isabel King to show at the Adam Gallery. They came around to see me at this space, and I had a show there of these little bronzes, which was great, beautiful space on Walcott Square, old kind of shop. I don't even remember the space, your kind of shop space. And I showed a series of bronzes there. I also, at the same time, I can't remember whether it was just after or just before, had a studio at the Angel. I think it was after. I had a studio. There must be after actually, because I seem to remember having the. Well, it was 1993. I had the show at Mario Fletcher Gallery in Liverpool Road, and that was a similar series of works. It was 1992 at the Adam Gallery, 1993 at Mario Fletcher, and he'd seen the work in the studio at Angel. So I also had a studio at Angel, and we did open studios at Angel. A huge artist complex on Torrens Street, and we had open studios there. And I think that was the first big open studio I participated in. Nothing through Acme or Dyers Hill Road. I think they did them, but I just did more people traipsing through my house.
Mm. And also, because you mentioned really the domestic kind of scale of the space,
yeah.
Wasn't as suitable to your work. You really needed a warehouse.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I mean, strangely enough, the work I was making at Dyers Hill Road stayed in scale, as it were, when I went to the other spaces, because the next one was flats, and then there was the prefab. So they were all, and then I ended up showing in two spaces that had been previous shops. So strangely enough, the work was, in terms of scale, was quite small, and it just stayed that way. If one could say it was a domestic scale, it stayed that way until a while, mid-90s, I think. And then I started to make much larger scale works in a tiny space. So it's strange. So I guess that whole domestic thing, I mean, I think I just didn't have, I don't know. I've always made small works. I've always made tiny works. I just didn't have any ambition to make anything large scale. And it's, you know, and I suppose that fitted with places like the Adam Gallery and Mario Fletcher, these little
and
shops.
It's also because you've always worked installational.
Yeah.
It was in a way like small pieces that then would fit together in a space.
Yeah, I think there was. I think yeah, maybe that's always been part of the contract. I mean, I've always thought that there were small pieces made with the intention of hanging together or it becoming like a unit. So one of the shows was titled Bronze, and it was all bronzes, but I'd conceived this idea of having plinths and works that went next to the plinths. And So yeah, I suppose, yeah, small units coming together.
Yeah.
Very IKEA. Sort of small little things all clipping together. So yeah, so I think, yeah, the first big open studios was Angel. I can't think of much that came out of it. I quite enjoyed the experience. I think it was linked to one of the East End open studios, even though we're M1. It might have even been linked to the Whitechapel. I think it might have been. I remember getting lots of visitors, but not much coming out of it. But yeah, I didn't do it Dyer's Hall Road. I just didn't want people in my house, I think.
Yeah.
House studio. And it was so small that, you know, the space there. Although people did do it, but no, it was never for me. I think it was more to do with, I think if people turn their house into a studio plus living area, but we definitely had a kind of downstairs living area that I didn't want people traipsing through.
Because I remember those open studios, because Helen Sloan is the curator, but she was actually at the William Morris Gallery at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Doing some quite interesting installation, kind of shows, exhibitions.
Yeah.
And she went around the open studios in Leighton and Leightonstone, and she said she felt really conscious going in, that she was actually in people's private spaces. So I suppose there's kind of downsides to that as well. Yeah.
Well, I did it. I mean, I did the tour. I mean, partly out of nosiness, but I just felt I should. And I felt exactly the same. I felt it's bad enough going into studios, depending on what people have done to them, because it's quite intimidating for you and the artist. And you're sort of like, you know, you've dropped your artistic trousers in that space. And it's even more so when you let someone into your house and your studio space. Yeah, I didn't like the experience. Because people have said things like, can I make you a cup of tea? And like going into somebody's house where you haven't been invited. Strange. Not a good relationship. Much better when with those big cavernous Carpenter's Road type places, where you just wander around aimlessly. That was a much better experience. And that was the only one I'd had at that time. And then when I left, when we all got thrown out like Acme from John Scare House and Limehouse, because they were turning them into better standard residential flats for council tenants. So we all got chucked out. We had a group show of all the artists who were there. There's myself, Simon Callery, Paul Harrison, Rupert Clausen, Kabir Hussain, Dean Watmoth, a bunch of people who were all there, Matthew Roberts. And we had a show called Thank You Very Much, which was just this parting show. So we invited lots of people. And everybody had a flat to make work in. It's quite nice, actually. So we had this evening, some early spring evening. So every artist had either their own flat or somebody else's flat. We'd done up a bit, liquor paint and all that. And they just showed slides and installation, and some people came around and cooked. It was fun, a lot of fun. That was our parting gesture to that place. And round about that time, after the sort of Adam Gorry, Mario Fletcher thing, I was invited to show him. I mean, I was looking on my CV now. So quite a few group shows, which led to a nice show in Turin with some interesting artists, Matt Collishaw, Maurizio Catalan, Helen Chadwick. It was quite nice to meet her. It was the last show she had before she passed away. Kind of sad, but she was lovely. Nikki Hurst, John Franklin. Nice show, really good. But so I was kind of like, you know, a lot of things were happening on that level. And then I suppose, did it all end in 94? The whole Leightonstone thing? Yeah, by which time I think I'd sort of moved on. I mean, I think I'd physically and in sort of, I think I'd just moved on from there. And it was a good move in some ways. But I wasn't there at the end. That's terrible. It sounds like some battle or something. But I wasn't there at the end. I'd sort of gotten out just before all that.
You know, you mentioned that you did go around the open studios. You have any memories of that now?
Not really. There was a guy in our street who I remember somehow. I went to a place in Wigan. I can't remember all this. Very well. I went to a place in Wigan where they were doing really interesting arts projects in schools. And they'd invited a guy who was on my road who did these kind of woodcuts.
Okay.
They were really strange. I mean, in hindsight, this was like late 80s. Mid-80s, late 80s, which was the time of people like Stephen Campbell, and I mean, figurative painting was very big in Britain.
Mm.
And he was doing sort of figurative, like Kirchner, you know, that German expressionist woodcuts, but big things carved. And I think, I can't remember whether he would print off them or if he'd just paint them. I mean, they sound terribly hokey now, but at the time he was pretty successful with them. And the strange thing about the story was, I remember going to his, I'm sure he had an open studio, and being quite impressed by, but I was more impressed in his case about how he'd managed to make the workspace stroke living thing different to me. I mean, he had a much bigger area. I think even all downstairs was his studio. I was just being nosy. I don't know much about
it. All free.
Sort of, yeah. And he'd made the studio paramount. Whereas my studio was shit, it was rubbish. It was fucking rubbish. I just hadn't made it into a studio. You know, some people can do that. I'm rubbish. Even now, I mean, if somebody hadn't built this, I'd just work on brick walls or something, you know. Sure. But I admire those people who, you know, build shelves and sliding partitions, but that wasn't me. And he'd done that. And he had a tool rack. And I also remember going to, because what was strange is, like a lot of these things, with open studios, I ended up going to friends or some people I already knew.
Mm.
So I went to Jeff Dennis and Joss Clark's house because I knew them. And again, just being impressed that, you know, Jeff had written down all the things on Radio 3 that were like interesting pieces of music. And I thought, I should do that. I'm always hearing music and never writing it down. He'd written down these. Thought that was cool. And he had all these tapes classified. But it seemed so cramped. It seemed so tiny. I couldn't understand how we could paint that.
So had you, when you say he wrote down all the classical music that interested him, was that on the walls? Or
yeah, he'd written it on the walls. I think it was on the walls or like on a notice board, like jotted it down in pencil. And I remember thinking this was really sort of like intelligent. And I sort of do it myself a bit, but I could never be that forceful in that I would do it with, you know, lots of it.
Yeah.
I'd just forget or I'd just get into the music. And I remember, you know, and I think that's why I went mad over studios, to steal other people's studio practice. I didn't really look at it.
So was you actually...
I just went, well, they're nice shelves. Ooh, that's a good idea. Mm, maybe hang it there like that. Cool, that saves space. So it was a bit like, you know, home decor or something. I would go around and I'd have a perfunctory look at the work and I'd think, ooh, yeah, a glass palette, what a good idea. I wouldn't steal, like, ideas for work, but I'd steal some, oh, yeah, what a great idea, put your kettle there. Oh, yeah, so you could use the one, yeah. You can use the hot plate for wax and cooking soup. So I would, I'd go around and do that. But I remember going to Jess, I remember going to this guy's whose name I can't remember. It was basically people, I went to your house once, but I don't know if it was an open studio. I did go to your house, I remember. You invited me. Did you do an open studio?
I did do an open studio.
I think I did go and see
1988.
You.
1988.
I went to see
Projection
you.
Projection installation.
Yeah, I went to see you. And it was a few people I knew. Another guy called Ian Edwards.
Okay.
You know? He was working at the Whitechapel. I went to see him. But I think it was just people I sort of knew. But I get confused. I can't remember that I went around for a glass of wine now or... whether, but I just remember that guy's because I was sort of curious because somebody had mentioned him in Wigan and we lived on the same street, so I just sort of picked my way through. But I don't remember any conversions on the road to Damascus. There was nobody who kind of went, wow,
yeah,
that was fun. It was just sifting
through.
What
about Jeffrey Dennis's studio? Because you knew him quite well, didn't you?
Well, I did, yeah. I knew Jeff because when I started working at the Whitechapel, he stopped working. I don't think it was because of me, but he had done really well. I think Satya bought several of his works. And but his studio was incredible. And I haven't seen it since. He's moved, obviously, since. But it was the most domestic. It was you know, it's sort of how I imagine Magritte's studio. It was a living room or a back room with, you know, postcards stuck everywhere. And like some paintings on the wall, some stacked against the wall, like a couple on an easel, all sort of, you know, not very big, 2.5 foot by. And I just thought, how the hell can... But in fact, that's how he painted. On, you know, with it on top of him, very, very close. And it was funny because I saw the paintings in an exhibition and I thought, you know, it's that quality, in fact, in some strange way, that makes them intriguing. It was that very quality of being on top of them that made them intriguing. Because he didn't sort of... He focused a lot. I mean, I don't think it was only that, but he focused a lot on a minutiae within the paintings. And it's strange that his partner, Joss, she was not dissimilar. Both of them worked in this very kind of tight, minute sort of way. And I always wondered if that was whether we are affected by things like that. But his space, it just seemed so cramped and so tiny, so domestic.
And he was working with wallpaper at the time, wasn't he?
He was, I think so, yeah. He was collaging wallpaper and having bits of paint that evoked the wallpaper, and the two would run into each other. It was like a trompe l'oeil kind of on the surface type stuff. But then, you know, the drain pipes were coming in, and all these domestic things, and the figures cut through the paintings. So yeah, he was really very successful, Jeff. I mean, he still is, but it was like quite. He was one of that first wave of young British painters that Saatchi brought. And quite a few of his work from some crazy show in Stratford. So it was all tied in with that locale. So I think Jeff actually was the, sort of like the hottest kid on the block, as it were.
Yeah.
In that whole area. Well, pre Grayson Perry and all those guys.
So you say Saatchi bought one of his pieces from a show.
Several, I think.
Would it have been in the Tom Allen Centre?
Because
that
yes,
was the
that
only
was it.
Place at Stratford, wasn't
that
it?
That was it, the Tom Allen Centre. That was it.
God,
wasn't that in the theatre or the cinema?
It's actually at Maryland. It's just a little stone's throw away from the station.
Maryland Works, is that it?
Yeah. That's
is that
it.
Now?
Yeah.
Was that then?
Then. It's been demolished now.
Yeah, it was a Tom Allen Centre. That was it. Where people show up. God, yeah. There was they were the type of spaces that people showed them, weren't they?
Mm.
Incredible.
And there were some really good shows at Tom Allen, I can remember.
Really?
At the time, yeah.
I kind of came in a bit late to all this because I think they'd had them from, you know, 85 onwards. And by the time I arrived in 86, 87, whatever it was, they'd already had some good shows. Jeff, I even missed Jeff's because I didn't know him.
Mm.
But he was one of the first wave there as well. So, yeah. And the word was it was a sweet little venue. But I did go later because Jeff did something else later, like a group thing. But I was shocked when I went. I just thought, oh my God, this is like a library space at the end of the earth. It wasn't how I couldn't imagine that somebody could buy anything from there. Or I was thinking, God, it's the end of the peer show. It really is. But it wasn't. It was just part of it, something. But I just didn't understand that. I thought, you know, galleries were in the West End.
So probably, I mean... Jeffrey Dennis probably had a few galleries and stuff going around his house to look
at his
work.
Think so, yeah. I would imagine so. I know he was represented by a guy in, I think, in Milan and New York or Salvatorella. He was a big dealer then. He showed people, he showed people like Shirase, Hagere. You mean huge, big, and a lot of big Italian painters who were all big then, like Clementi. I don't know if he showed them, but Salvatorella was a big gallerist then.
Yeah.
And he was shown in Italy and America by him. And I thought that was the most glamorous thing ever. Like, Jeff went to New York to show paintings. Wow. But I still can't understand why he was living in Leinster. Jeff, surely you should have a penthouse now, or like Julian Schnabel. You should have a big loft, Jeff. And Jeff was working away in his small space. It just didn't click that he didn't do that. So, Jeff, wow, New York. And I remember him going to New York, telling me about it. It just seemed like so far away. New York, wow. And they put you in a hotel. Wow, fantastic. And very low key, but just, you know, I was more excited than him, I think. But yeah, but I don't know about London, I think. There were a couple of galleries sort of maybe interested. There weren't that many galleries then, you know?
No, there were, weren't there?
Nowadays, it wouldn't be, you know, somebody would snap him up like that if he were that sort of artist. But there weren't many galleries.
No.
There was Listen and... I mean, there weren't many very good galleries. Listen, smaller little space like Adam Gallery, Mario's, but...
Do you think there was more emphasis then on open studios?
I mean, there was a... Yeah, there was a greater will to be involved in the open studios. And what happened with open studios was that it was where people went to look at art, buy art, to curate exhibitions. They'd go along, see somebody, leave the card and say, hey, I'm curating the show, get in touch. Nowadays they go to BA shows or degree shows. So open studios are sort of like, seem like the thing for losers. But they're not. I mean, I love them. I think they're great. And we did one here, which is a complete cock-up.
Yeah.
An absolute cock-up. And I think, you know, they should be for people who don't go to spaces. They should be for those people who are curating shows who want to pop in. People being nosy. Mm. Friends you haven't seen, colleagues. I like them. I think they're good. But they're a thing of the past, I think.
Mm.
I think they're sort of, along with the Whitechapel Open, something that that kind of will doesn't exist anymore.
It's strange because, you know, you say kind of half jokingly that open studios are for losers. But it's like,
that's this perception.
I think the people that have got studios are the ones that are quite successful because the rents are quite high now, really, aren't they? I mean, you have to be...
It depends where you are and who you're with, because even that is a game now. You know, which studio you're with and who you are, and then there's like a hierarchy of studios now. Yeah, no, you're right. On the one hand, it shouldn't be that way, but people are making work that have negated studios, you know. There's so many artists I know who don't need a studio, who... invent things or fabricate things or have things made. They don't really need a studio. I think, it's not really the studios for losers. It's just that notion of people sat there with a kettle boiling and a glass of wine and a plastic cup waiting for people to come in and discover them. That seems such an archaic notion.
Yeah.
But it's not about that. But that's the way it's perceived. It's not. It's about inviting people into your studio who don't get a chance to go to studios, I think, and making them open to, you know, for people to see. But
yeah.
People don't go to studios anyway. I think that's a thing of the past as well. Curators don't go to studios anymore.
No.
They've stopped doing that. They curate everything. A bit like the degree shows. Think of the Biennale or Basel Art Fair. I pick up a magazine. I mean, it's heinous. You can't. You know. Would you like to come out to the studio and see the work? And you can see this look on their face. God, what? Going to the studio? Be physically involved with the work. So, and I think that all of that ties in with them being, it sounds slightly cynical and nostalgic, but they're things of the past. People don't want to confront the work anymore.
Mm.
They don't want to be in the studio.
And then you're doing this show, aren't you, which is specifically, you kind of think, right, I've got to go to the studio and see the artist's work, and that's the whole point.
Yeah, I'm totally going to go and see it. I'm definitely going to go to the studios and see.
Can you say a bit about that show, really?
Yeah, it's, I haven't done a title for it, but it's about, I think it's about very delicate, fragile things. So it's about works I admire, plus some of my own collection of things I own, which are kind of slightly ephemeral. Plus it's also the notion of, curating like a gentleman. So the things, I mean, that's a slightly fey Victorian, Pitt Rivers, John Soames, well, he's not Victorian, but Horniman, you know, gentleman type curating. I sort of like, I think he has a name like topological or something. It's just like when you categorize things. But I wanted to curate a show with people I admired, plus objects I like, and it not be descriptive. So the works I like and I admire, other kind of works that are very difficult to write about. Because you can't come in... they're the kind of works that you have to go through the work to write about them, as opposed to standing there and saying, well, what Stephen does is he takes the and then makes D and then makes C and D, which seems to be the way that most writing is these days about art. And I prefer it, you know, for people to have a sort of poetic experience or something. Or a correlation between objects, or see some connections. So it's a bit,
That's the idea behind the exhibition. And so far, I'm just going through the process of picking 5 or 6 artists who intrigue me. Mm. A couple that the gallery owner will suggest, I got to go and see. But yeah, I want to see them all. I mean, the owner of the gallery, Lucy, she was showing me the stuff in catalogue, saying, well, what about this artist? And I was going, well, yeah, but... And I wasn't being rude, it was just she was showing me them and saying this, and I said, well, you know, fine, I'll go and see them, but this means nothing to me. Mm. And it's that physical quality, it's only being in a place where somebody works, can I see where, what they're trying to achieve.
So in a way, you're doing a curating show, which also shows the importance of visiting the work in the studio.
The importance of physically selecting the work, yeah. Mm. Or being, I mean, I really want to, it would be wonderful in one way if I went to the studio and picked out the most fucked up works in the studio. If I went and I said, that's the one I want, and they went, oh, well, that's my brush cloth. But they were happy to let me have it. That's the kind of thing I'd like to curate. I mean, it could be leather. So I want to go there and just say, at one point I was going to say, look, just send me your worst work. Send me the one you really think is the most problematic and unresolved and nobody would ever buy it. That's the other thing as well, partly with the show. I want to show works that nobody would ever buy. So there's all these kind of like ideas which are just sort of like slightly antagonistic, but crazy. You know, I want the opposite. Everybody wants to buy something. I want the opposite. Everybody wants to, you know, sum up a work in 3 sentences. I want the opposite.
Yeah.
Everybody wants, and so I want, everyone wants to curate something in context. I want it to be out of context. So there's all this sort of going into the exhibition. But yeah, no, I want to, there's no way I'm curating anything out of a magazine. And the one piece that I actually saw in a show in Siena by a Bosnian artist, I want to try and get hold of as well, which I think is a fantastic piece, just made me laugh. Mm-hmm. But I've seen it. It's not, you know, I've not seen stills, I've seen the whole video. So, yeah, definitely. I want to see all the work.
Do you think, I'm just sort of thinking back to what you said about the Whitechapel Open and people actually bringing their works into the gallery, just for submission, really. I'm also just thinking about what the kind of workshop stuff you did at Whitechapel and I was saying, like, you always managed to make the kids laugh and stuff like that. Do you think that maybe there's any connection between that time and kind of what you do now in the sense of the physical?
Yeah, maybe. I think in hindsight, which is a great thing, it all ties in. I know it all ties in somewhere. Even just talking about the scale of the work initially, why small? It's kind of the antithesis to where I see myself. But and the ethos of that time, even now with my colleagues and friends, was sort of like slightly gregarious, making do, getting by, helping each other out, making connections, curating each other. And I think that's gone, that will has gone slightly. And I think bringing your work, it's really interesting. I know it's absolutely stupid, and at my age, I should not be doing this, but I applied for a show, one of these, apply for a show and you get a show at Aspects Gallery in Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And I just did it. I don't know what possessed me. I just found myself. I do it every now and then. I do it about once a year, twice a year. I put slides together, I put them in an envelope, I send a check for £15 away, and 3 people curate something or other. And sometimes it happens, like last year was good, I was in this open in Deptford, and I do it about once, just as like a practice to see what's what. And it was somebody from Wales, and Paul Hedge and somebody else. And when I sent it off, I gave it to my partner. I said, look, I'm going away. Can you send this off? She sent it off. And I thought, as I sent it off, I thought, what am I doing? I'm sending them £15 for them to curate, to give the money to Paul Hedge and this other person, to stand judgment over whether somebody should get a show. And I thought, it's like fucking Britain's Got Talent or something, American Idol. I'm covering all their bases. I've got to make the fucking work. I've got to mail it. I've got to take photographs of it. Send them £15 to get a fucking show at Aspects. And I just thought, whatever happened to the curator at Aspects gets on the train and goes to look at people and says, hey, I'll curate the show. This is my taste. This is what I like. I went to see this person. She was wonderful. I believe in her. And I just thought, it's just everything so like the opposite of what I was led to believe it should be. It's almost like curating by subscription, you know. I have a magazine subscription. I'm qualified to curate. I get, you know, I get flash art every month. Him, her, him and her. And you just think, oh, just for God's sake, get off your arse. Go and invent, go and see, go and believe. And I think that's sort of gone. And the great thing about the Whitechapel Open was, yes, you had to pay for the submission. It was quite cheap. Jenny Lomax and Sir Nicholas Sorter had to walk around the fucking gallery and look at work. They had to do it. It wasn't, you know, they had to do it. And it's strange. And then they just, that process is gone. Of people wanting to look and engage. And I think the process is almost gone. On lots of levels, people want to be entertained, but I don't know if they want to be engaged and challenged. And I think that's all symptomatic. So yeah, I guess that I was just brought up at that time on the cusp of, I mean, I it's a bit wee, but it's sort of analogous to, you know, I follow football, and it's analogous to that period in football when people went from being, you know, enjoying the game, loving the game, being involved in the game, and it being quite interesting to this, you know, to within the space of 10 years to being a world of global superstars. And it kind of happened in art a little. I mean, we were the last generation where people, we didn't even think we would get shows. There was nowhere to show. Our highest aims were things like SpaceX and John Hansard Gallery and Axiom and Cheltenham and the Icon. And they were the spaces we aimed for, I thought. They were the kind of things, or Chisnell maybe, or... and now the goals and aims are completely different. You know, now people want to show White Cube. And so we were on the cusp of all that. So yeah, I came from that, you know. I curated my own shows. I'm still doing it to some extent, but...
Because that kind of makes me think about also universities and, like, when they're making appointments of staff. And everything is point scoring as to who's got the London shows and RAE points and stuff like that. Are you teaching anywhere?
I teach at, a bit, bits and bobs. I mean, I have in the past done lots of visiting. I mean, but I've just started working with Edwina Fitzpatrick at Wimbledon, with part-time PA. And I really like it because they're all grown-ups and they have lives. And on one level, you know, if research points, I mean, Jesus, I wouldn't count for anything. I mean, it's actually better than I think because I do a few bits and bobs. But, you know, you're right. I mean, but why... But I enjoy teaching, and you know, and that's slightly different than having lots of shows. But the whole, yeah, the research and points system is just ludicrous. But I did teach. I taught 2 days a week at Tahamath College on the BTEC course there, which is like pre-degree course, like a kind of overall foundation. So I taught there, and I quite enjoyed that. But it was getting more and more challenging. The intake was not as good as it should be. They were really number crunching.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a shame. But I liked it and I believed in it. And I like that age group that, you know. But, so I'm doing a little bit for Edwina at Wimbledon. And I teach in Italy. I take gap year students to Italy. And look at works of art there, which is quite good.
And going back to Dyer's Hall Road, because you left there in 94, didn't you? So
yeah, maybe a bit before, I think.
But probably around that time, like, were they starting to board up houses and stuff? Like, what did the street look like?
Yes, that's very true, actually. Yeah, that was just before I got out. Yeah. That was very strange. That just changed the... It was, you know, the... It wasn't a death knell, but... everybody became very conscious of, you know. I mean, like all these things, you think, hey, they've said 2 years. Because it was 2 years, that's how long you had your house for. And then it became 3 years, and they went, ooh, 4 years. And then there were rumors going around, things like, well, some houses are staying. How do we find out which houses are staying? And then, you know, people would ask around, and then, hey, I've heard somebody is allowed to buy their house. And rumors would abound again. And then you started to see these boards go up. And I think they happened. So as people left, nobody took up the vacancies. And then it started to get a little sort of, a little like a sinking ship. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, that's not good karma. It wasn't a good feeling. You didn't want to be the last one or two there, mm-hmm. although some people were. Because also as that happens, socially, you know, you get all kinds of strange problems like squatters and, you know, if it's less safe, there's less people in the streets. The last days were, you could just feel it happening. It's like feeling of dread and, oh, shit, we've all got to go.
Can you talk about that sort of strange story about the door?
The door, yeah. No, that was...
Was that a bit earlier?
I can't remember when that was. That would have been about 1989, something like that. We had... the dog was grown up, so it must have been about 1989, 88. I remember just waking up early morning, like 2 or something, and the dog growling and thinking, that's weird. Because she was pretty calm. And she was kind of growling at the door, and I thought, oh, that's very strange. So I grabbed her, opened the door, and she didn't bark. She was still growling, but like tentative. And the door was ajar, but there was mist in the house. It was slightly Stephen King. It was very bizarre. And there was mist in the house. It was really dark and cold, so it must have been February or January. And there was mist in the house, and I think, that's so strange. But being aware that there could be burglars in the house, went in the front room, nothing, turned the light on. Sent the dog upstairs. She came down, all right. So I went up, had a look around, opened the studios, fine. Bathroom, fine. Went back down, must have left the door open. And then looked out in the street, couldn't hear anything. It was so quiet and still. So I just closed the door, thought nothing of it. And then got up the next morning, and my favorite leather flying jacket, which I loved with a big fur collar, cheap, but it was great, really warm, had just gone. And I just had this vision of seeing somebody on the street. To this day, to this very day, so like several years on, with my fucking coat. And I just thought, what a strange thing to do. Well, it was a cold night, so I thought, well, maybe they really needed it. But it was the kind of coat that was so distinctive. They must be wearing it somewhere in the world. They must have had to wear it, but I just can't think who it could be. It was that's what the most interesting thing is. It can't have been one of the artists, because they would never have worn it. I'd have seen them, because we were over the same places. But it was just strange. Just that was the one thing they'd taken. And it was just behind the door. Such a strange thing. I guess there wasn't anything else. Or they hadn't got far enough into the house before the dog started growling. But, yeah, bizarre.